Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, it's back to school time, and parents are shopping for all of the things their student will need. Jay Fox will speak with an expert on the cost of getting kids geared up for a new school year. And we'll learn more about postpartum depression in men. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Columbus is the largest school district in the state of Ohio, with over 45,000 enrolled. Back to school costs are soaring. As these students head back to class, rising prices, looming tariffs, and tight school budgets are having an impact on back to school spending. Some parents simply can't afford what is needed, and educators are bearing that burden. Becky Pringle is the president of the National Education Association and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing well, but some of these kids and their families are not. How are tariffs and tight budgets impacting back-to-school spending?
Well, you already know that I taught 8th graders the wonders of science for 31 years. So I necessarily, it's like built in, to be honestly, that this time of year, I join others in the joy and excitement and the anticipation. I have grandchildren. My little granddaughter is with me now, and she is a little anxious about meeting new friends and going to a different classroom. But they are excited to go back to school, and parents join them and educators join them in that excitement. But I will tell you that this year, that excitement is joined with anxiety, beginning with our parents and families. They're already seeing the impact of the economic uncertainty, the rise in the tariffs, which, by the way, are going up again tomorrow. And so they're seeing as they're going to clothing stores to buy clothes or certainly going to the market, they're already experiencing as much as a 15% increase. Now it's back to school, and that's a time where you're buying more clothes and you're buying the school supplies and all of that. And so parents are rightly concerned about shopping as their kids get ready to go back to school. What does that mean for our schools and our educators? Well, we know there'll be more students who have wider gaps in what they have ready with them when they come to school. And we know that too many of our students won't have the tools and the supplies. So what do our teachers do? They do what they always do. They stand in the gaps. They try their best to meet needs. They buy extra pencils and crayons. They have book bag stuff. They do drives right before school starts. They buy tissues and paper towels, all of that. That's a lot. And for most teachers, it equals at least $500 at the beginning of the year. And as they go throughout the year, they have no idea what they're going to encounter because of the economic uncertainty. So educators and parents are very anxious this year because of this administration's actions that are making it much more difficult for them to meet the needs of our students.
Let's quantify this, because some folks who might be listening to this say, oh, it doesn't matter because there's always a school resource fair and they pass out this and they pass out that. But there's new data that shows exactly how much this is impacting educators and school districts. What does that data reveal?
Well, let's just look at Ohio as an example. Not only is it that there are increases in prices of everything that are impacting our families and our schools, but we know that Congress just passed a big, bad, terrible, really no good bill that Donald Trump signed into law. What's that going to do to our students and our families and our schools? Well, let's just talk about the fact that we have far too many students coming to school who are hungry. And what did this bill do? It cut funding to school nutrition programs. In Ohio, 700,000 families families will lose those benefits. That's more hungry students. We know students can't learn if they're hungry. Let's take a look at Medicaid. That's going to have a huge impact on our students and our families. In Ohio, over 3 million children and adults are enrolled in Medicaid. And we know that for the children, they're approaching just over 40% of them that depend on Medicaid for health care. So our students can't learn if they're not healthy. That's a direct impact on what happens in our schools and the additional widening of the gaps that our teachers try to close. But I will tell you, they're not going to be able to close those gaps. They are too wide. And so we have to demand better from our politicians to do more for our students instead of billionaires.
Well, it gets deeper than that. You know, for years we've had Head Start and pre-K education programs, and that funding has been cut as well. So for a 5 or 6 year old who's entering kindergarten, having never been in an educational setting other than perhaps daycare, what does that do to that child? How far behind is that child now going to be?
Well, we know that they will struggle. We have certainly evidence to prove that. We are doing our very, very best in our schools across this country. One of the things that we know helps is an understanding of the entire community that it is our shared responsibility. That when we say every, we actually mean every. So we have we've been fighting and demanding funding for community schools, which actually approach our students from the whole students they are. So they're providing right within the school nutrition-based programming. They're providing additional health care. They're providing opportunities for families and parents to get support and assistance. So that the school itself is a hub of the community. That way, everyone's coming together to identify and try to meet the needs of those students. But I will tell you, there is no doubt that all of these cuts will have impact on our state governments and their struggle to try to close funding gaps, not just for our schools, but for healthcare systems, as well as our local government. All of them will be affected. Ultimately, it's our students. We know that they're going after pre-K education, which absolutely forms that foundation for our students' learning. We know that more colleges and universities are losing funding, which means when our students have done everything we've asked them to do and they want to go on to college, they don't have that available. Our students who want to go on to careers have less funding for career and technical education. This is not okay. And this is a direct threat to public education in this country.
Are rural and minority students being targeted? Is that what's happening here?
There's no question that our students and families who live in rural areas, they've always struggled because of the inequities that are built into the funding system in this country. So we know that our families that live in rural areas don't have the property funding to actually support their public schools. We also know that their public schools, especially in rural areas, are that hub of the community, and so all the other services are not available, that they especially, disproportionately, honestly, depend on for their families to meet the needs of their families. The same is true in urban areas, where, again, inequities that have been built into every system, social system in this country, impact our urban communities in a disparate way. And so those students, those schools that have historically been underfunded depend on the federal government to help to meet those gaps more than others. And so they are hardest hit, and we know how that will impact them. It's going to be harder to attract and retain teachers in rural areas, in urban areas, because those teachers are not getting the resources to meet the needs of the students, and they can't possibly stand in all those gaps.
So what can we do? I know every year I go out and I buy some boxes of Kleenex and paper towels and crayons and pencils and take them to the local school in my neighborhood. But is that even enough now?
You know, Jay, and you know, when I said before that it's everyone's responsibility, it's a shared responsibility, I want to begin by thanking you, because we all need to care about our public schools and our students, even if we don't have children in those schools right now. So thank you for what you're doing. But we know that this government actually has the money so that you don't have to do that. You shouldn't have to do that. Our teachers don't have to do that. Our parents don't. The question always is not whether we as a country have the wealth. The question always is whether we have the will. And right now, the Trump administration is demonstrating first, and they said it very clearly in Project 2025, that their goal is to dismantle public education. We understand that it is public education is the foundation of this or any democracy. So we literally are fighting for our democracy. We also know that they are working to attack educators and our public schools and voucherize them, taking funds away from those schools and from our students most especially. So it's important that you are buying tissues and paper towels. We need those things, but what we mostly need is for everyone to join our movement and lift up their voice and demand that elected leaders do what they must for our students. So we want you to join our movement.
This is a deep subject, and we're going to watch how this impacts the 2025-2026 school year. I want to thank Becky Pringle, president of the National Education Association, for another lesson. As we do every time we talk to her, we sure learn something. You can visit NEA.org. That's NEA.org for more information. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
The city of Columbus averages around 26,000 births per year. When we think about pregnancy and delivery and all that comes after, we are familiar with the term postpartum depression. We immediately think of the mother. New studies show that it is possible in men as well, and as many as 1 in 10 men may be suffering, perhaps in silence. Pediatrician Dr. David Levine joins us now to talk about this on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
For those who might not know, what is the definition of postpartum depression?
So postpartum depression is one of several perinatal mental health disorders that can occur in either parent, and I mean either caregiver. It could be a mother, a father, it could even be an adopted parent or a grandparent, whoever the child's primary caregiver is during that first year of life can suffer from mental health disorders that are directly or indirectly related to the birth of the child.
What causes this condition?
There's a lot of different factors that are involved. It's a mix of the person's prior history, somebody who has a history of anxiety or depression that could be worsened. It's hormonal, it's environmental. And unfortunately, in many cases, we're not even sure what caused it. And I can tell you that I was one of those cases.
So that's my next question is, you know, I have 2 children of my own, and I went through 2 pregnancies with my wife. And in her first pregnancy, she did experience some postpartum depression. I did not. How was it determined that men suffer as well? How did you learn that?
So I can tell you that I learned it personally by going through it. Before that time, I had no idea that this even existed. Over the course, my son is 11 years old now, and over the course of the last decade, there's been increasing research and awareness of this as an issue that new fathers can experience. And it comes about in many different ways. It can look different in different people, but there are several commonalities that if you're aware that they can exist, you can look out for and recognize.
Is part of it just the change in life that occurs when a couple goes through pregnancy and then has a child? Life is never the same.
Correct. And we all know that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of stigma attached to men even acknowledging this, because there's this feeling that, well, one, you didn't carry the baby, and two, you don't have the hard part of the job. The hard part was the carrying, the birth, and the nursing and or other care that mothers typically do. But a lot of dads are a lot more hands-on today than we used to be. And some of us are just not as well-equipped as we thought we would be. And, we're, you know, contrary to popular belief, men do undergo a lot of similar hormonal changes in their bodies, in their brain, during and after pregnancy that we think can impact. It's like there isn't any one thing that you can measure or say, oh, you don't have this or you have too much of that, and therefore you will experience it. It is very different for different men, but there are, as I said, some commonalities that have to be looked out for. And if recognized, this is a very treatable problem.
From a sense of relationship, prior to having children, the couple is the priority for each other in the relationship. But when you introduce a third party or a third and fourth party into the family dynamic, the man could feel sense of isolation because so much attention is being paid to the baby. Is that part of the problem?
Absolutely. There, that is a big part of it for some men. For others, it's the, I want to take care of a baby that I have, and I have no experience. Like, think about when you were a dad. My guess is, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but your dad probably wasn't a super hands-on dad, and his dad probably wasn't a super hands-on dad, because generationally, that's not what our fathers did. Like, my father very honestly said, like, I never changed your diaper. And he wasn't even sure if he'd ever fed me a bottle. My mother did all those things.
My father said, that's exactly right. My father said to me, I wasn't in the delivery room with your mother. Why are you scrubbing in?
Exactly. But our, like, we want to be a part of our child's lives. We want to help our wives. Either they work or we just have, like, our generation of dads wants to be more hands-on, but we do not have generations of experience that can be handed down to us, where our, like my dad or your dad, couldn't go over to us and say, son, I know how you're feeling. Do this, try that. That's what worked for me. Most of them are like, I don't know, or aren't you just happy to be a dad? Like when I went through what I went through, I told my parents, and my dad would always just say, but your son's healthy. Like he's okay. What? Why are you worried? There was nothing that could be related. And that, as I said, like there isn't a one, this isn't like a one size fits all thing, but no matter what it is, men do experience these things at a rate of, as you mentioned, 1 in 10, but it can be sometimes even more than that. And we just suffer in silence. And as we all know, men who suffer in silence, things don't go very well.
Well, and I think it goes a step further than that. Men in general do not like to admit that they have any kind of emotional or psychological problems whatsoever. There's a stigma to seeking mental help for men just in general. So now you add this to the mix. And like you said, no support from other generations because they didn't have the experience. Now you're made to feel guilty for feeling what you're feeling.
Absolutely. The amount of shame that many men feel for feeling, they have shame for feeling what they're feeling. They have shame in admitting. And then, you know, when you have that much shame, it is unlikely that you're ever going to get help. I don't know how old you are. I'm going to be 48 years old. I am an 80s kid. I grew up in the era of Stallone and Schwarzenegger and these like big, these solid, these men, like masculine men who were always there for their spouses and raised their kids and all of those things. And whether I believed it or not, that was in my head when I'm a new dad and all I'm feeling is a completely incompetent. I can't do anything. My son just screams and cries. On top of that, I'm sure the fact that I'm a pediatrician did not make things any better for me. But in there was this, I'm failing. I am not doing this well. And you are absolutely right that men just, we are not good at these things. We are good at a lot of stuff. We can learn things, we can do things. And that's what's great about being a dad is you can learn to be an amazing dad. But it doesn't necessarily come as naturally to us as it can for moms. And it doesn't come naturally from all moms either. As you mentioned, your wife went through something, mine did not, but when one spouse does, there's about a 50% chance that the other spouse will. Luckily, you did not, and my wife did not suffer for what I was going through. But in our heads, in my head, was this feeling of total failure. I was one of the last of my friends to have a kid. None of my friends had ever mentioned anything like this to me. I was taken aback by it. But I was also very lucky that as a physician, I at least had some idea of what I could be feeling. So I was able to look it up, find out that maybe this is a real thing, and eventually get some help, and I was able to get better.
Well, and it's also not just a psychological or an emotional condition. It could be physical as well. I gained 50 pounds with my wife during pregnancy with my first daughter, as did she. We didn't gain that much weight the second time because we learned what we were doing wrong. But any time that she had a malady, I felt a similar malady. And, you know, we like to call those sympathy pains. Was that part of the investigation, the empathetic physical manifestation of pain or suffering as a result of what the spouse is going through?
Absolutely. It's not just the physical, those same reasons that you felt that way, that you gained that weight. That was also because of neurotransmitters and all of these chemicals bopping around in your brain in response to becoming a new parent. And for some men, that really wreaks havoc with our heads and can lead to feelings of anxiety and eventually depression.
You're a physician, which makes you innately curious by trade. So you went and you looked something up and you educated yourself and took action. But not everyone out there is of the same belief system, if you will, and won't do that. So for those who are not physicians, how do we know when we have a problem and how do we know when it's time to take action?
You're very right. I am lucky. I am 100% fortunate that my job and where I worked at the time allowed me to get better. What people can do is they can educate themselves. For the parents that are listening, they have to know the signs. Either for the wife or the spouse to know that men, if you're looking for a sad, anxious, tearful guy, you're probably not going to find it. You're going to see a guy who's more irritable, angry, lashing out verbally, hopefully not physically, more isolated, working later hours, taking on extra jobs, doing some more stuff just to avoid having to be around the rest of the family. Somebody who enjoys a glass of wine once in a while is drinking more. A beer or two becomes a six-pack. You have to look for those signs. Either in the dad themselves has to be aware that this is what's happening, or their partner has to be able to see these too and acknowledge it. For the physicians that are listening, especially pediatricians, you have to know that this is a thing. Whenever I have a new parents come in, whether it's before they have kids or in their first visit, I am very honest with them. And you're right, I have the ability to do that other pediatricians don't. But I just tell them, look, this is not easy. If you feel this way, know that that's because there's something wrong with you. I try to destigmatize this from the get-go so that a parent, if they're suffering or they see suffering in their spouse, they will ask me or tell me. I educate my fellow pediatricians in my office, in my group about it, and we screen every parent. There's something called the Edinburgh Depression Scale, and it's given oftentimes to moms, but it's not always given to dads. And we give it to both parents, and we grade it, and we monitor it. And it's a perfect excuse to ask more questions.
Now,
my
question was, and I didn't mean to cut you off, do the OBGYNs subscribe to the same theory and do the same things? Because if you're hitting it from both ends, you might solve the problem.
So they definitely know. As a pediatrician and not an OBGYN, I don't know how much they talk about it. The father is very rarely, I don't know if you went to most of your wife's gyno OB appointments.
It was mandatory. It was mandatory.
That's good. Most of us don't. And at the time, my wife's doctor was in a different state because we had just moved to New Jersey and she was still in New York. So I wasn't even around for I wasn't going to the city for most of those visits. But I don't know. We've tried. I have tried to get in with OBs to get to their conventions and speak to them about it. I've definitely spoken to nursery staff and people in my local hospitals so that they're aware of these things. But I don't know. But it is an important thing for OBs to talk to moms about, to say, hey, because they do talk about it towards the end of the pregnancy, and in that postpartum visit, they usually are screening moms. Different states have different rules about that, but they should be screening moms. At the same time, they can always ask, you can fill this out. You can ask a mom, fill it out for your husband. What do you think that he would say? And that's been a pretty good indicator of what's going on with the father.
You talked a little bit about being a certain age and having a different perspective than prior generations. I'm a little older than you are, but the Bible for us was a book called What to Expect When You're Expecting. And it would have been nice if there had been a companion piece called What to Expect Psychologically, Mentally, and Emotionally When You're Expecting and Beyond. Is that something that is forthcoming, perhaps?
I can tell you that there have been attempts to create such a thing. Book publishers, I think there's some that are published, self-published, but there isn't anything specifically for dads. There are a couple of newer books for moms specifically about maternal issues, but that's important. But the problem is a lot of dads don't ever read those books. Like, there's never been anything specifically geared towards a father that they can read, because when it's meant for the mother, we're not going to read it. I mean, men don't read a ton anyway, but we're not going to read a book that's meant, we think, is going to be meant for mothers to read.
So where can we go to learn more and find resources to deal with this issue?
So that's the best thing about today, is there is so much more information, so much more available to parents. The best place to go is postpartum.net, which is the website for Postpartum Support International, which is the largest volunteer organization that is available for new parents of all stripes to get help. And there is a app called Connect by PSI. There's a phone number, 1-800-944-4773. All of these are 100% free. You call that number, you will get somebody on the line for your state, for your locality, to help you find resources locally on the website. There's tons of information. There's a dad's chat once or twice a month through PSI that is, again, free and anonymous. A spouse can call, the dad can call, and just speak with a professional, a expert on this, where they can just ask for assistance. I think the most important thing for dads is it is something that, this is treatable, this is a real thing, but you can overcome it. I have a great relationship with my kids, and I did not think that that was going to be possible based on what I went through for those first 6 to 12 months of their lives. And that's really, really important. And as long as people know that this is a real thing, that there should not be stigma, and that they can get good information about it, dads will get better and families will be stronger. There's no good family that comes from one or two broken parents. But if those parents are doing well, they're confident and they're healthy, that kid has the best shot.
We want to thank Dr. David Levine for sharing his insights on this most important topic. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Former Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown appears poised to run again for Senate in 2026. CNN is reporting Brown told Democratic allies that he intends to run in next year's election. They say two people familiar with Brown's plans told them he will launch his campaign soon. Brown lost the seat he held for 18 years to Republican Bernie Marino in last year's election. We received this statement from former Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan's spokesman, Dennis Willard. Quote, Sherrod Brown's decision to run for the U.S. Senate has renewed and heightened Tim Ryan's interest in running for governor to further serve the people of Ohio. Brown's decision to run was first reported by Cleveland.com. He'll face off against Republican Senator John Husted. Governor Mike DeWine appointed Husted in January to fill Vice President J.D. Vance's vacated seat in the Senate. Brown, a three-term incumbent, lost to Republican Bernie Marino in one of the most expensive races in U.S. history back in November. I reached out to several people in Democratic circles and several others close to former Senator Brown's previous campaigns, but have not heard back or they had no comment. I also reached out to Senator John Husted's campaign. Spokesman Tyson Shepard sent me this statement saying in part, should Brown enter the race as Schumer's hand-picked candidate, he will be starting in the biggest hole of his political career. He has never faced a candidate like John Husted. Whoever wins the special election in November of 2026 will serve the rest of Vice President Vance's term, which runs through 2028. So they would have to run again in 2028 to hold on to the seat. I talked with Democratic strategist Dale Butland and Republican strategist Matt Dole to get their perspectives on the candidates and the campaign ahead. Both say their candidates have strong name recognition and records of service in the state of Ohio. Here they are speaking about the strengths of the candidates, starting with Butland on Sherrod Brown, then Dole on John Husted.
Not only is he up to the job, but he's going to stand up for working people in this state. And that's something that John Husted is not doing. John Husted is turning his back on working people and kicking them off their health insurance so that he can give another huge tax cut to people who don't need it. So I think that the mix of issues, the fact that Sherrod will be able to raise a lot of money, because let's face it, there's going to be a lot of people, a lot of contributors who are interested in holding, in taking back the Senate. And this is one of those seats that if we can steal it from the Republicans, there is hope that we might even be able to take back the Senate, although that's going to be a tough row to hoe.
Yeah, John Husted will be a formidable candidate for the U.S. Senate. He has been a Speaker of the Ohio House. He's been Secretary of State. He's been Lieutenant Governor. He's been involved in a number of different areas. He's establishing a credible record in the U.S. Senate. He's a good fundraiser. He checks all of the boxes. And I think the Republican Party in Ohio, which has endorsed him, is thrilled to have him as a candidate, regardless of who the opponent is, but certainly against the Democrats' best chance in Sherrod Brown.
Dole also said midterm elections favor change agents, and Sherrod Brown cannot make that case because he's been in politics for decades. Butland says Husted will have a lot to answer for example, voting for the Big Beautiful Bill, which the Congressional Budget Office estimates will add as much as $4 trillion to the national debt.
Husted's got a lot to answer for, to say nothing of the scandals. We have the First Energy thing out there, which we know now through text messages from the First Energy executives he was right in the middle of. We know that he got $1 million in DART money to in a contribution to a nonprofit that was backing him. So John Husted's got his fingerprints all over the biggest scandal, or what the U.S. attorney, former U.S. attorney, who's a Republican, said was the biggest bribery scandal in Ohio history. Husted's fingerprints are all over that. So I think, given all those things, this is a perfect time for Sherrod to run, to say nothing of the fact that it's the first midterm after a presidential election, which history tells us is very good for the party out of power.
Let me speak to the dark money claim. First of all, Sherrod Brown ran the most expensive race in U.S. history last year, and overwhelmingly the amount of money in that race was quote-unquote dark money, independent expenditure money. So I think it's just silly to try and, you know, use scary words like dark money to make that case against John Husted. Furthermore, I'll say that if Democrats are going to depend on HB6 and the Big Beautiful Bill to defeat John Husted, I just think it's a losing proposition. I think that President Trump is still popular. I think that the Big Beautiful Bill is the reason a majority of Americans voted for him, and he won a landslide victory in the Electoral College. And I think John Husted is being true to where residents of the state of Ohio are in his votes and work in the Senate so far.
Of course, we will continue to follow the race for the U.S. Senate and the other big races leading up to the 2026 primary and general elections right here on Face the State, 10TV News and 10TV.com.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Same-sex marriage is back in the headlines. Advocates for same-sex marriage say a development in the U.S. Supreme Court won't change their timeline for getting two constitutional amendments on the Ohio ballot next year. The U.S. Supreme Court is being asked to overturn the 10-year-old decision that legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. A co-chair of Ohio Equal Rights says they set the November 2026 election as their target to get the amendments on the ballot, and whether the Supreme Court decides to take up the case or not won't change that.
I'm sure that Ms. Davis will want a answer sooner rather than later, but process still has to happen the way it's supposed to happen.
Ohio Equal Rights co-chair Lise Regula is referring to Kim Davis. Davis is a former county clerk in Kentucky who refused court orders to issue same-sex marriage licenses in 2015 because of her religious beliefs. A federal jury ruled in favor of a gay couple against her. She filed an appeal this week in the U.S. Supreme Court. She's asking the justices to overturn the Obergefell v. Hodges decision, which legalized same-sex marriage.
If Ms. Davis's case does go forward and is taken up by the Supreme Court and is used to overturn Obergefell, then we are back to a position where people who happen to fall in love with someone who is the same gender as they are do not have access to those same rights that a heterosexual couple does.
Ohio Equal Rights will soon start collecting signatures for two proposed constitutional amendments. One would prohibit discrimination based on a long list of categories, including race, religion, and sexual orientation. The other calls for the repeal of Ohio's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. Right now, marriage is defined in the Ohio Constitution as only between a man and a woman. In a statement in July, Stonewall Columbus Executive Director Denzel Porteous said, in Ohio, same-sex marriage would currently be illegal under our state constitution if not for the Supreme Court ruling. That means if Obergefell were overturned, we would see those rights vanish overnight. Regula believes it's critical to protect those rights.
Anybody can marry the person that they love. Anybody can benefit from the privileges that come along with that marriage.
We reached out to the Catholic Conference of Ohio for comment on the issue. A spokesperson pointed us to the Catholic teaching on marriage, which says in part, marriage is a lifelong, faithful partnership between a man and a woman. It is made for the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of children.
It all depends on what the Supreme Court does. It can accept the case or decline it. Meantime, Equal Rights Ohio will start collecting signatures for the two proposed constitutional amendments. They need 414,000 valid voter signatures for each amendment to get them on the ballot in November of 2026. Ohio Congresswoman Joyce Beatty held a forum in Columbus last week to hear from seniors and others about their concerns about Social Security. At the forum, the Congresswoman talked about workforce cuts in the Social Security Administration and how a potential funding crisis for the program is impacting people. 74 million Americans receive Social Security benefits, including nearly 2.5 million Ohioans. Some seniors at the forum say they're worried, confused, or frustrated with cutbacks and changes at the Social Security Administration.
But I only have $200 to $300 to live on.
Dozens of seniors and some younger people filled this room at the Fran Ryan Center in Columbus to tell their stories and hear from Congresswoman Beatty and other panelists about the current state of Social Security. Jeanette Hayes is one of them. She's disabled and counts on her benefits to get by.
And I keep getting these things that say, okay, overpayment, and then they'll raise it up and take it away, raise it up, take it away. So I don't know what to do. So I came here to get answers.
People like Jeanette Hayes are why Beatty said she held this forum.
It was important because people have questions, people are concerned, people are frustrated, people are scared.
Beatty's office says the Social Security Administration has lost about 20% of its workforce through buyouts, retirements, and other cuts by the Trump administration. She says smaller staffs make it harder for people to access their benefits at local Social Security offices or get help over the phone.
People should not have to wait 3 and 6 months. People should not have to only call my office because they can't get a call back from Social Security.
People also asked about the Social Security retirement age, which is 67 right now for full retirement, and what steps can be taken to make sure Social Security benefits don't run out. That's a real concern. Experts are warning of potential reductions in benefits in the years ahead because the Social Security Trust Fund is rapidly depleting.
I think that's one of the things that we need to look at a reform, but it can't be something that an administration just says we're going to do this without looking into it and giving people information and the facts.
While she definitely wants answers, Jeanette Hayes says she also has faith things will work out for her.
I'm very hopeful and prayerful, too.
Beatty also addressed proposed Social Security field office closures. I asked her if the main Columbus field office would be closed. She said she heard it was on the list, but couldn't answer that definitively.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.